Hello and welcome to the Armenian News Network Gurung. I'm Aspet Bedrosyan, and together with Aspet Kochigyan, in this Conversations on Gurung episode, we'll be talking about the relations between the diaspora and Armenia, especially in the aftermath of the war in Artsakh, and more. This episode was recorded on Wednesday, April 14, 2021.
Hello everyone, I'm Aspet Kochigyan. Since Armenia's independence, the diaspora as a whole has been in a constant soul-searching process. The new reality of an independent state has challenged the principles by which diasporan identity has been shaped for decades, raising questions as to the relationship between the nation and the state, as well as the role of the diaspora in supporting the new republic. Armenians in the diaspora, just like their compatriots in Armenia, are now at a crossroad again. How to process the recent war in Artsakh? Not only politically, but also psychologically. Are there different views and perspectives about how the diaspora should move forward? Today, we will be talking about these issues and try to contextualize Armenia-diaspora relations with all possibilities and opportunities that define those relations. To talk about these issues, we are joined by Dr. Viken Hovsepian. Dr. Hovsepian holds a BA degree in political science from UCLA and an MA and PhD degrees from the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California. His specialization and his doctoral dissertation are related to U.S. foreign formulation and decision-making, particularly as it relates to the Middle East. Dr. Hovsepian has held several leadership positions in various Armenian community organizations. He has served as member and chairman of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation Western U.S. Central Committee. For a dozen years, he has served on the ARF Bureau, the highest executive body of the organization. In 2019, he helped establish the Pan-Armenian Council in the Western U.S., which up until today brings together 24 community organizations in an effort for them to be in constant dialogue and to coordinate their activities with each other. Dr. Hovsepian served also as PAC's first moderator. As a full-time career, he serves as an advisory board member at the Golden State Bank in California. He is the author of many articles which have appeared in professional periodicals as well as Armenian press. And he also writes poetry, both in Armenian and English. Hello and welcome, Viken.
Hi, Aspet, and hello,
Aspet. Hello, Viken.
Okay, Viken. Thanks for coming on this conversation.
Thank you.
It's a grand, grand topic. It is something on everyone's mind. So let's try to process it bit by bit. Sure. I want to start our conversation with the last couple of years in Armenian politics. What were your thoughts about the change of the Armenian government in Armenia since Pashinyan and MyStep came to power in 2018? Specifically, how was it viewed by the diaspora, yourself included, obviously, or at least the diasporas that you are connected with?
First of all, thank you very much for having me on. I know you two personally, and I know how much you've given the nation and the service that you've provided us all through this platform and generally through the work that you do. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
So the question is, a broad one, Aspet, and let me try and address it in the following manner. I think Armenia needed a change when the events of 2018 happened. Some call it a revolution, some call it an upheaval, some call it a movement,
change of regime.
Whatever it was, change of regime, whatever it was, that change needed to happen, right? Whoever was at the helm is pretty much secondary in that respect. So in that respect, I think most everyone, unless you had something that you were losing in terms of career or in terms of a special interest, you welcomed it. And I was one of those who welcomed the change. Now, did we as a nation or as a state, did we make the best use of that change? I don't know. Certainly, things don't look that way. Was it a missed opportunity? I would say definitely yes. The ones that held power, are they accountable for that? Absolutely. But then again, there's also a big role for civil society that I think was abandoned by us all, in a sense. And here we are. Here we are, and we're discussing it. Also in the present reality, which is the post-war reality, which obviously somehow is going to dictate us a different set of priorities and so on and so forth. But yes, I welcomed it at the time because we thought we needed the change. And so here we are.
Right. What you're saying, the need for change was there and people did welcome it. Not just you, a lot of people did. And I think the nature of that change, where it went through without major upheavals, internal upheavals, meaning bloodshed or any kind of a damage, major damage. I think that also injected some enthusiasm into the overall Armenian nation, right? Be that sitting in California, for instance, you would talk with people. People managed to get into the streets and demonstrate, and there was a level of zest, if you want to call it, and a new interest in Armenia.
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a lot of trepidation, I think, and a lot of soul searching, as you said it. But I think overall people felt that if this works, then it's a good thing. It's going to be a good thing for Armenia and also for the diaspora. So it was a national phenomenon. And it was not just a coup of sorts that happened in Yerevan. And, you know, it was a true movement. I mean, the least you can say was a movement.
Definitely.
You know, and then people were hopeful. I know a lot of people in the diaspora that started thinking about, not because they didn't trust the regime before this one, but just because there was a mindset that did not look at Armenia as the place to go next, whether physically or through an investment or so on. But all of a sudden, a new page, so to speak, had been turned. And so there was hope.
Uh-huh. Right.
Everybody started having a certain hope towards Armenia. And that was, I think, welcomed. And that was refreshing. But, you know, events did not necessarily turn out the way that people were hoping for.
Putting aside events, Viken, one of the major criticisms or shortcomings, if one would call, is that the diaspora did not make good use of this opportunity, as well as the government, the new government didn't, in terms of synergizing or encouraging or trying to involve our diaspora in its activities. What's your assessment of that?
Well, listen, I've heard such commentary, and this is almost like a chicken and the egg story where, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg. A lot of people say the diaspora is at fault. A lot of people say the government in Armenia is at fault for not creating that synergy which you're talking about. But I think there's also an ideological issue that we have to overcome as a nation, in that Armenia has never been dealing with diaspora as a strategic partner, so to speak. I mean, we talk the talk. All of the speeches would include things like the diaspora has to be engaged and so on and so forth, but the mechanisms were never created, really. So there were no mechanisms. I mean, sure, diasporans as individuals probably knew what to do if they wanted to relate to Armenia. They would go get a passport or citizenship. Better yet, they would go and buy a piece of property or at least go visit once a year or once every 2 years. And that's a good start. That's great because that creates the bridge and it takes it out of just the emotional and just the totally ideological. It turns it into a real bond, right? Physical bond,
concrete,
which is the ultimate, right? When for example, for years and years, the ARF brought forth this idea of Tebi Yergir, right? Which was first brought about by Agnuni back in after the turn of the century, and now ARF was appealing to the diaspora to start the Tebi Yergir movement. The Tebi Yergir movement initially was regarded as a physical move to Armenia, but I've always taken it to mean more of a bridging process, where Tebi Yergir as an ideology, if it were to be developed to an ideology for diasporans, would mean basically creating connections with your homeland, different on different levels, all right? Probably your set of circumstances would dictate that you would create your bridge in a certain way, because you may not have any close friends or family living in Armenia, so it's going to take you through different paths to, you know, creating that bridge. It may start with just simple tourism and so on, develop into different things. But if you have family and friends and you feel, you know, you're familiar with the Republic of Armenia setting, so to speak, you can then, you know, develop different types of bonds. And so it was probably a call to looking back to Armenia as a very real presence in one's life. And
Dickon,
so
what you're talking
about,
sorry to interrupt, but what you're talking
about
assumes a temporal component, right? Meaning when you we have that message of Tebi Ergir, and you are actually sort of rewiring people's mind to work towards Armenia, to look towards Armenia, that also requires a period of time. Granted, between independence and 2018, we had that, and it did have that rewiring. But between 2018 and up until the war, there just wasn't enough time for people to readjust to the new reality.
Well, no, I mean, absolutely. Again, I'm not taking 2018 as a turning point. By all means, I'm going back to 1991 and saying that from 1991 onwards, when this whole Tebi Ergir notion was thrown out there, and people started thinking in terms of, okay, what does Armenia proper represent in my own life? Okay, because up until that point, we had all regarded Armenia as this distant land, which we felt some affinity to, you know, love and you know, devotion and so on. But in real terms, what did that really mean? But after 91, opportunities presented themselves. Now, in 2018, I'm saying there was a refresher of all that. So if you had slowed down in thinking about all your priorities having to do with Armenia, then in 2018, there was a boost of sorts. Your whole Tebi Ergir move and Tebi Ergir
mantra
was basically boosted once more, recharged.
Right. So then September 2020, the war started, and everyone in the Armenian world and beyond, and not everyone except, you know, people who were involved in pandemic, but we were glued to the news trying to figure out what's happening. At least from my perspective, it was, in retrospect, it was watching a train crash happening in slow motion. Could you just give us an overview? What were your thoughts as the war started? What were your, I wouldn't call it blame. We love to find blame or, you know, put blame on people. But what were your initial thoughts about the war when it just erupted in September?
The overall realization. Okay, first of all, most everybody at that point came out with comparisons between what was happening in 2020. So everybody basically started drawing parallels between this last breakout and also what had happened in the 90s. Well, first of all, we're talking about two different worlds, totally, especially in the region. Back in 1990s, Azerbaijan was a different state. Much weaker, totally in disarray. You had a less assertive leadership in Russia and all sorts of disarray back then in Russia. And of course, Turkey was a different country where there was no Erdogan. There was no belligerence at that level, let's say. So it was a different world. Of course, we were a weaker country as well, weaker setting and so on. But in comparison to all the different actors in our corner, so to speak, there were constants. But in the rest of the region and the rest of the world, a lot had changed, number one. Number two, since we were kids, I recall in different history classes, Armenian history classes and so on and so forth, being told that whenever Russia and Turkey have had a closer dialogue or have collaborated Armenians have lost lands, basically. Okay, I mean, I'm simplifying it, but this right. thought has been a constant, right? We've known this. And so events happened where Russia and Turkey started working closer.
Colluding even.
Yes, of course, we know about the anti-aircraft missiles and so on that were purchased from Russia by Turkey, which is a huge event. Huge event.
Right, if
you look at the NATO history and U.S.-Turkish relations, it was huge.
And now, it continues.
It continues, and the U.S. did not respond to it how it would have responded historically. So even though President Trump came out with certain threats, threatening certain sanctions and applying some sanctions also at the time, but really the response, at least publicly, was not what you would have expected from U.S. reacting to the second biggest army in NATO purchasing Russian arms.
Right.
So that should have been an indication that things are going in a different direction. Of course, then you come to Syria, you come to the Libyan situation, and you see how there is Russian and Turkish dialogue and then agreements. To me, at least, it was only a matter of time that Armenia or Artsakh was going to be next.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, happened. Now, I'm not saying that Russia promoted the Azeri attack. I don't mean that. What I'm trying to say is the Russian role and response was going to change, at least from a threatening presence for Turkey and for Azerbaijan to one where they were almost probably sure that Russia is going to be hands-off in the immediate war.
Yeah. It wasn't a single thing, like you said. I think it was more of a combination of the balance
Absolutely.
Of power in the region. And in addition to the three that you mentioned, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Russia, I would definitely add the U.S. in there,
sure.
Providing basically a vacuum of leadership, which got filled by the other three.
Yeah. And this has, of course, has to do with what happened in Artsakh, but it's overall. I mean, it was how international events were transpiring. I mean, to think that we're going to be away from it all, that there is a different logic over there, would have been very childish of us. And so once the war started, the proclamations by Armenian officials notwithstanding, that we're winning, we will win, and so on, all of that rhetoric obviously was probably war rhetoric, and now we know that it was totally exaggerated, at times misrepresented, and so on. All of that was one thing, but the reality was that if Turkey was totally backing Azerbaijan, you're talking about economies of 90 million, and you know the armed forces of Turkey and the technology of Turkey, and then there were discussions of Israeli drones being used by Azerbaijan and so on. That it was only a matter of time that we would succumb to all that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was the war waged properly? Or could there have been another agreement early on? Those are things where details lack. And I wouldn't even want to get into all those because, you know, we don't have the details. Sure, I can take cheap shots now and analyze it in a certain way, but that would not be prudent.
Right.
And definitely not objective, yeah.
Right. So, Viken, we're talking about the war. The whole diaspora is basically, again, in that soul-searching process, soul-searching that got a booster after April 2018, May 2018. And now suddenly there's this huge crash with the, call it because of the heightened expectations or exaggerations and so on. How do you think the diaspora, specifically talking about the California and Armenian community, process or has it been able to process all of this situation?
Well, there is different levels of feelings of inadequacy or impotence, right? Angarogutyun. As much as the people in Armenia now are in, I mean, I would analyze it as a state of depression, right? Not knowing what's going to happen,
right.
What happened, and so on. A lot of the blame game going on. But also for the diaspora, it's another level, because Armenia has, like we mentioned earlier, has never really brought the diaspora in the political affairs of Armenia and in strategies involving the national agenda and so on. So diaspora has always felt sort of once removed from all of that. And when the war happened, the immediate reaction was, okay, let's assist in every which way we can. And I think, you know, it took some time to organize and so on, but diaspora got on its groove,
yeah,
let's
it did
say,
come through.
Within a week or two or almost, right? But at the end, when the collapse happened, and basically we came out of it as losers, the diaspora's reaction probably was manifold. I mean, it was first that feeling of, okay, we are so removed, we're not even players in all of this, we don't even know what's going on, and yet we were assisting wholeheartedly, we were sending in funds, we were organizing marches and so on and so forth, and talking to political people and to the media and so on and so forth. But then again, we were not even players in all of this. Not only did we not have details, not only were we not involved in any sort of decision making, but really we were not even recognized. And absent a few mentions and speeches by officials in Armenia, the role of the diaspora has not been played up or determined even, has not been acknowledged. And so this creates another set of identity issues where now you see a certain phenomenon growing in the diaspora. For example, now we're almost going into April 24th and so on, and there are activities being planned, and there's a certain level of disinterest towards all of that. People saying,
I mean,
born out of frustration, actually, where, you know, what are we doing? What is this? Are we even players in all of this? And so, yeah, there is an alienation going on, and I really hope that the political elite in Armenia and diaspora, especially intellectuals such as you gentlemen, start talking about the strategies for the future. Strategies not only about the Republic of Armenia, so how it's going to come out of its quote-unquote funk, but also the diaspora. What do we do to re-energize the diaspora? This is a huge challenge now.
It is a huge challenge. I mean, but the thing is, we can, as non-citizen Armenians, what is our role in Armenia? And especially sometimes when we watch it go down a path which we disapprove or is self-destructive, what do we do?
Well, the mechanisms have to be developed. But, I mean, I've discussed this ad nauseum in interviews, and I've dealt with this topic in articles that I've penned and so on, that first and foremost, there's got to be a quote-unquote ideology developed. And when I say ideology, I used that term very loosely.
Understood.
Basically, where each one of us falls into this realm, the Armenian realm. Where does Armenia and its citizens fall? Where does the diaspora fall? Where does the diaspora and Armenian as an individual fall? Where do the organizations fall? And this search has not been done, all right? I mean, we just have cursory looks at all of this, but there's got to be a whole set of priorities established, first of all. And then, because, you know, this question is already come up a million times probably, and now lately it's being discussed again, that I read a few articles by people I respect lately saying, well, you know, in the last years, the diaspora did everything it could for Armenia. It's the resources that it had, instead of investing them in diasporan structures, basically it redirected them towards Armenia and assistance to Armenia and so on and so forth. You know, there's a discussion about this now, but I'm afraid it's not going in the right direction, because then what the conclusion would be, in order to have a strong diaspora, you have to stop assisting Armenia, so to speak. And I don't agree with that. So if proper discussions and proper prioritizations don't take place in the form of set of ideals, let's say, okay, let's call it a set of ideals, or if that doesn't happen, then I'm afraid, you know, we're going to go in directions which are not necessarily healthy for the overall national agenda, if we ever come up with one.
One of the things that Asmet Petrosyan mentioned is that sometimes diasporans are not happy with the way the government of Armenia or the state in Armenian state actually follows certain policies in a certain way. But the question is that also diasporans don't realize that what they perceive as what a policy should be like is not necessarily the best one for a state. It's not the best one for a government to take. So there is a romanticized version of how things are in Armenia. And how can one bridge this gap to make people more involved? There should be more synergy.
Sure. This is why I was saying earlier that all these priorities have to be discussed time and time again, rehashed, and strategies developed. And so that what I'm saying doesn't sound too esoteric or sort of a wish, part of a wish list. I think efforts have to be made. I recall back in 2015, the Gulbenkian Foundation in Lisbon organized a symposium. I attended it. I was one of the lucky ones to be there. And a dialogue started there. There were about 30 to 40 participants. They were selected by the foundation. And there were some discussions. Well, that discussion, it was called Armenians in 2115. Basically, what it meant was, okay, 100 years from now, where would we be, right? And there were different perspectives and ideas thrown out. But that lasted for a day or so. And that kind of thing, for example, had to have its sequels. And there had to be some follow-up done, right? More discussions and so on and so forth. Now, this was just one example. We can have many of those different entities organizing their own sessions and their own deliberations. And some thought has to come out of all of this. Because now it's, I can throw some ideas at you as to priorities and so on and so forth, but there's got to be a filtration process at one point. Something needs to come out. Just like the example I always give, and when I discuss about the power of ideology, which, of course, for you gentlemen, I don't need to justify, but I say that when 1988-1989 rolled in, what percentage of the diaspora really knew anything about Artsakh, or back then Nagorno-Karabakh, right? Not that many people really knew about the history and so on, about the realities there and so on. So it was not even part of the everyday reality of the Armenian diaspora's course, you know. And then as we start discussing, a whole ideology surrounding Artsakh came about, and it became a national priority. How did that come about? It was not because somebody came out and came down with a diktat saying, okay, from now on, you know, there was no proclamation of such saying, okay, from now on, this is a national priority for everybody, including diaspora. People evolved into this.
Yeah, just to add about this, it's amazing that you talk about this. It's funny because I was in Lebanon at the time when the Karabakh movement started, 1988-89. And one of the questions I had as a teenager, at the time, late teenager, almost an adult, let's call it, was that why are all the posters about Karabakh in Armenian? And why are they all in the Armenian community? Shouldn't this be audience for the foreigners, for the non-Armenians? And eventually I realized that it was an affirmation for Armenians themselves to educate, to inform, but to also say that Qarabağ is Armenians, guys, remember.
Yeah, it goes to the point where if something is going to be brought to the level of a national priority, Armenia, diaspora, and so on, there's got to be a process, right? Not every priority is quote-unquote dictated by a war or by an emergency. And it behooves us, the ones that think about these things and talk about these things and write about these things, to start developing strategies. And I don't see that.
Right.
I see a lot of interviews. I see a lot of pundits go on TV. I mean, especially in Armenia, all these quote-unquote pundits, and by all due respect, 80-90% of them are pursuing an immediate political goal in Armenia and the elections and so on. So I don't see very many, you know, intellectuals and people who think about these things and write about these things sharing thoughts and ideas about what the future holds for us and how we should, you know, we should develop our national agenda.
And that flows back right to what was called in the last few months the group of 17 plus that were demanding the resignation of the prime minister, right? How many of us know the agenda, the philosophy, the ideology of any of the parties involved? Well, we probably know one or two of them, but that's about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the
many
the
of them
main
are
players.
One-man parties.
Yes, yes, and the main players, but that's the reality of Armenian politics in Armenia, basically, because you've had so many of them, where one individual starts a party, which is always the case, huh? I mean, even the most established parties started by a few individuals taking the lead, but it soon evolves into something much more broad-based. In Armenia, the case has been different. The individuals who started the party becomes the face of it, and the main player, and the one whose personal priorities become the priorities of the party, because they're the ones who provide the funding and so on. And so, yeah, you have that phenomenon.
Viken, is that a function of the maturity of the democratic institutions and the politics in the country, or what?
Probably. Listen, once we moved into the parliamentary system, one of the things that is to be expected from a parliamentary system is that that maturity of political parties does occur. So some of them go by the wayside and just die. Other ones are created, other ones merge, and so on. But unfortunately, once that parliamentary system, unfortunately for the evolution, for the maturity, I don't mean unfortunately in the larger sense, but since this parliamentary system was instituted in 2015, things have happened in Armenia. One of them is the 2018 Velvet Revolution, and then the war and so on. So we haven't had much time to devote
to institutionalize it.
Exactly. So hopefully in time, if we have some peace, you know, there is, as you put it, a lot of soul searching in that process, there's going to be some reshifting of political priorities and loyalties and so on. And I think there's going to be a much more traditional setup of political parties and so on. Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful in that respect.
Yeah.
As much as right now all the mudslinging and so on and so forth don't create the necessary environment for level-headed political discourse. I mean, every political proclamation or every political discussion includes the blame game right now from all parties. So there is no, you know, nobody's really discussing beyond Pashinyan or beyond Serj Sarkisyan or beyond Levon Derbedrosyan. It's always a discussion is focused on these individuals, and without realizing that there are things which are more constant, and hopefully the future has other forces that are going to build it, I mean, in terms of the future, rather than just these individuals. Especially in a parliamentary system.
Right. In Armenia, where politics is polarized and not necessarily ideologically or issues, it's rather about people and street politics. It seems that that has also been exported into the diaspora as well. How do you see that? How do you see these next 3 months up until the possible election playing out in the diaspora? How would the diaspora at all reposition itself?
Allow me to disagree with that aspect, because yes, if you go on Facebook, the average diasporan that is on Facebook and that is active politically has an opinion about events in Armenia,
right.
And of course makes commentaries, sometimes insults and so on and so forth about things that are happening in Armenia. But the diasporan life itself, and I'm taking a few examples, such as let's take the United States Armenian community, or let's take the Lebanese Armenian community, or the Canadian for that matter, okay? Or any other.
Okay.
You don't see in its day-to-day activities and events, you don't see that political reality come in. Oh, sure, you have marches, you have protests and so on against Pashinyan, against so-and-so or whatever, but those are, you know, just a part of the overall picture, but they're not, they don't really affect the everyday Armenian diaspora life. The institutions
not within the diaspora, not within the diaspora, we can rather in terms of the diaspora's perception and relation with Armenia.
Sure. As much as Armenia becomes the lab, so to speak, where things are happening, everybody's watching events there, right? This is where everything's happening. That's why earlier I was saying the diasporans become a little bit more, you know, once removed and become alienated from all of that because they're watching all of it on TV or on Facebook, don't feel a part of all that. Sure, they have opinions about it, but they don't know how to channel it. The only way to channel it is if you want to protest and you go and take part in an anti-Pashinyan protest of some sort or whatever. But how else can you participate in the process there? And the reason why you can't is because even before the war, even before Pashinyan or after him coming to power, we have not developed the mechanisms. Sure, if you're a member of a political party that is active now in Armenia, and really, except for the ARF, I can't think of any. I know that some other parties claim presence in Armenia, but really, there is no connection between their diasporan entities and their entities in Armenia, unfortunately. So how does any Armenian living in the diaspora take part in the political processes, even at a lowest common denominator level? You know, I don't mean being involved as much as like a citizen in Armenia who's living in Armenia would take part. But there's got to be a mechanism by which an Armenian that says he or she is an Armenian and that's part of the Armenian life. A lot of people are totally engaged in community life, let's say, and they think they're serving a national purpose. Somebody who goes and acts as a board member in a parish, in a church, does not feel that they're just doing it for the church itself. They think they're serving a larger purpose. So why not make use of all that and create a certain identity, which then comes back and defines a role for the diasporan Armenian. So in that respect, yes, we watch it all. We're frustrated. We have opinions about it, maybe, but there's no way to channel it, really.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Viken, obviously with the elections coming up in Armenia, potentially, that might even reverberate in the diaspora and its perception. But hopefully after the elections themselves, once things start settling down, the dust settles down, you think the diaspora would be in any position to reevaluate again or to think about reevaluating its relation with Armenia?
Sure. I mean, the diaspora is not a unitary actor, as you know. I mean,
right.
It's very amorphous. So the leadership and the political elite have to think of mechanisms, ways to engage people and to relate them to the realities in Armenia. Like I said, now mostly it's if you're going to do some fundraising for Armenia, you're involved in it. A lot of people during the war, let's say, took it to the next level, and what they tried to do was, okay, well, participating in sending goods and supplies and so on and so forth. But this is all. I mean, you cannot go on like that. I mean, that during national emergencies, whether it's a natural disaster or a war or whatever, that has a place. That's great. And that's how it should be. But as you say, in peaceful times after the election and so on, you still want these people engaged.
Right. Mm. But when you say we can't go on like this, what's missing here? In Telethon's past, we used to collect around $10 to $15 million. And this last year, after the war, the Telethon collected $170 million. So the diaspora stepped up tenfold, in a sense, tenfold closer to Armenia. What more needs to be done?
Sure. Well, that's great, but that's only in terms of assistance, financial assistance that you're providing, and that's great.
Right.
But really, is that the level of participation you want to allow the diaspora in Armenian? Taxation without representation?
Well,
is that all?
No, I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, what I minded about that money being handed over to the government into its revenue budget is that essentially it became taxation without representation. Until now, we felt like if we give to the Armenia Fund, we're giving as a charitable effort and whatever. But now it suddenly moved into a revenue budget of the government and became a tax we paid.
Yeah. And you know, I'm all for a tax, but also we need to, like I say, I keep on repeating the term mechanism, because I don't want to talk about a specific set of structure. I have some opinions as to how that can be done, but that's a whole different topic, really, as to how we can organize all that. But there's got to be a different mechanism. And I'm not even talking about the parliament. I don't believe in making the diaspora a unit on its own necessarily, okay? Mm-hmm. So I want to be clear about this, because there are people who have opinions about this and promote that kind of an idea. That's not what I believe in. I think that Armenia is part of our identity as long as Armenia allows a certain type of participation, then that participation needs to happen. Now, when it was a Soviet era, there was no ability to participate in Armenian civic life in Armenia or political life in Armenia. But now I can envision, or one can envision, different mechanisms, different ways of developing such participation. And that needs to be streamlined and promoted.
Right, absolutely.
Some thought has to go into it. But for all of this to happen, again, I come back to that ideology, that set of ideals, the belief system, where we need to understand that the diaspora needs to understand that so long as Armenia is independent and it allows for all that to happen, that participation, it cannot function on its own, and it has to have better bridges built. This is very important. It's part of our national identity. It's what makes us Armenians, and so on and so forth. The homeland is very much, is a presence, should be a presence in that identity. And vice versa. It's almost ludicrous for for Armenia and its political elite not to make best use of its most natural strategic ally, which is the diaspora.
Resource, yep.
Exactly. And I think we've only tapped those resources. I mean, okay, so we raised how much? 150 million? Maybe 110 of it or 120 of it was donated by a diaspora in Armenians. I think, and I say this with all humility, because I don't want to sound pretentious, but I think the diaspora has tenfold the power of participating in Armenia and donating for causes in Armenia and the Armenia Fund and so on. Sure. If that truly is the mechanism, you know, of course there are questions surrounding that now, and people are questioning as to, you know, how the funds were spent and whether that's the place to donate and so on and so forth. And again, even the response to all of that, I need to say that has not been adequate. It's almost like, okay, we'll get to that later on. But, you know, it's urgent. You need to make sure that these institutions are well preserved, because a lot of thought and a lot of dedication and devotion goes into donating money. A lot of people have donated. Okay, so maybe some people have donated just, you know, a few dollars here and there, but a lot of people have donated amounts which definitely affects their family finances, right? So there is a devotion there. You have to be respectful of all of that. So all of that goes back to that national agenda, national identity, and the set of ideals I've been talking about and calling an ideology. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they're so casual about it, you know, a government official gets up and says, for example, that a part of that those funds were transferred to the government budget, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. And that's probably something that should have been done. But have there been further clarifications? No. So that topic has been used and abused, and you know, now people have doubts in their minds.
Absolutely. There's an issue of trust and accountability that needs to be worked out.
Sure, sure.
We've been talking with Vikend Diasporan, Vikend thinker, Vikend community activist. And I wouldn't let you go till I ask you your perspective on a question that has been in the news recently about what has been happening in the ARF. As a member, you've been in executive positions before. You do not speak on behalf of the party, granted. But there have been a lot of reports and news items, somehow uncharacteristically, about so-called rift between the ARF in the Western United States and the Bureau, which is headquartered in Armenia. Could you provide some insight as to what is this and why is it so public? Which is, again, as I said, quite uncharacteristic of the ARF.
Yeah, it's a really complicated and loaded question, Asped. And let me just start by saying that not just my biography, but my psyche, my life, as to how I've developed it to the extent that I've had control over it, has been really led by an ideology and a worldview that has been consistent and one and the same of what the ARF's ideology has been. Mm-hmm. Not only in Armenian affairs, but also in terms of worldview as to how I perceive the world and inequities and so on in society.
Justice.
So that has been very part of my life, and I've tried to stay true to that, and I've tried to develop my life and my priorities according to the ideals promoted by the ARF. Now, having said that, yes, I've been active. I have not been on any official positions or leadership positions in the past 5 years. The ARF is a very complex and unique organization, all right? It has dealt with different phenomena, whether those have been local challenges in different communities, or they have been things that Armenia has faced and so on, or the organization itself has faced. It has dealt with them, rolled with the punches, as they say, and it has had some resilience. Disagreements between ARF members and disagreements between leadership and ranks and so on has always been part of the ARF reality. But at times, these disagreements basically seep through different aspects. And sure, lately it's been in the news that there's been some disagreements between one element, let's say, in the Western region and the Bureau. A lot of it has to do of this most recent rift. It's a purely organizational phenomenon. I mean, Sure, there are political differences at times, you know, views. For example, I, as an ARF member, may not be comfortable with some of the things that the ARF as a whole is doing or the things that they're pursuing. But then again, I try to manage all of those disagreements mm-hmm. into my, you know, my, what we call it, the discipline, right? The organizational discipline. Right. But what just occurred, and that's what you've been reading, is not necessarily mandated by these kinds of differences and differences of opinions. It's a purely organizational arrangement that the Bureau came out with. It had to do with the Western region. The Bureau decided to appoint a central committee in the region, and the region, or some of us at least, thought that the appointment was not warranted, that the region is capable of electing its own leadership, and it had to do that. So hence started the whole problem and disagreement. And it developed, unfortunately, when something like this happens with present-day realities of Facebook and so on and so forth, a lot of other interests come into play, and then the disagreement is played up, and of course everybody starts talking about it, because as you sort of alluded to, we've seen or known the ARF to be a lot more closed environment and one that follows a certain organizational discipline. And when things like this are discussed about the ARF internal life, even though I would say 90% of what's been discussed and written are just stupidities and are just, you know, people just pour fuel on the fire and take it to a different place, which I resent, but it is part of our life, you know. Mm-hmm. This is how life is today, and, you know, we're not immune to that.
Yeah, to me, the uncharacteristic thing was that, like you said, there's usually a process inside the ARF, so they deal with their own problems internally, and from an external perspective, there's a show of unity, and this time it just suddenly spilled into the press, and it felt very unusual for that to come out.
Yes, yes, it is unusual, and it is truly sad on one level or another, whether you agree with the ARF's positions or actions and so on. More than anything, the ARF has been a national treasure and has been an entity that has really given a lot to the Armenian people and to the Armenian nation. And anything that veers it away from it functioning at full speed or, you know, to its fullest is to be lamented, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't be happy about it. However, having said that, I would like to take this and look at this as an opportunity for the ARF to deal with a lot of its own challenges. And maybe, as the saying goes, you know, whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this will serve as a little bit of soul searching within the ARF. And hopefully the ARF will come out of this a lot better and a lot stronger.
So from a timing perspective, I wanted to ask, is the current situation that Armenia is in politically, heading towards elections and the ARF being a contender or part of a bloc, is this going to hurt the chances of the ARF? Is this the right time to have an internal issue come out in the middle of all these political upheavals?
Well, it certainly can't help. All right. But, you know, a lot of these... Something erupted back in December, and that's what you've been witnessing 100 days since. But really, a lot of these things probably were in place. I mean, there were disagreements. Probably the Bureau, the institution of the Bureau, was not probably fully happy with the Western region. The leadership of the Western region at times has not been happy with the Bureau and certain policies and so on. Internally, those have been hashed because we have our meetings and those ideas clash, and, you know, you try to come out of it with some sort of a compromise, if a compromise can be reached, or the democratic way, which where the majority basically determines what's to come and so on. However, the disagreements have been probably exaggerated, and I don't know why. All right, I really don't know why, but certainly these disagreements have nothing to do with the last few years, huh? Mm-hmm. Because I see a lot of commentary, whether intentional or unintentional, that this is post-Pashinyan, that Pashinyan is, it has nothing to do with it.
I see.
As a matter of fact, a lot of these elements were present even before Pashinyan, after Pashinyan. Let's just say that if the Western region was the culprit, but then again, what happened was there was a bureau decision to appoint a central committee that basically started all of this. Before, the Western region was organizing events, anti-Pashinyan events, and so on. So it was not like there was a huge, you know, rift there where the bureau came in and appointed. So as to why they appointed, we know what's black on white as to what the Bureau has said the reasons were. But I'm personally not satisfied with those reasons. But I guess at one point you need to ask them as to why they did what they did, why they did it at this particular time of national emergency, so to speak. What was it that couldn't wait? And what was the purpose? I don't know. I personally, I mean, I can come up with certain theories, but none of them are going to take us to a good place, right?
And probably we can, this is a microcosm, right? The ARF being a microcosm of the Armenian world, the turmoil that overall Armenian world is going through. And yeah, not the same causes, but obviously it manifests itself in different ways in the ARF. So it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, right? The diaspora talking about soul searching, they're trying to figure out what's happening. It's about synergy and so on and so forth. And this is a manifestation of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, things happen and then they get to breaking point. Something happens and then it either readjusts, takes things into consideration or you know, just circumvents it, whatever. Something happens and then it moves on. Now, the ARF is not going to die. The ARF is going to continue in one way or another. My hope is that this will become sort of a soul-searching experience at the end of the day when all the blame game is done and, you know, the animosities are put aside. And there is some soul-searching and a reset. Right? And we just continue. Because after all, what is the ARF? It has been created for a set of ideals. Those ideals have not been accomplished yet. And so there's still a purpose, a mission for the ARF to accomplish. Now, whether that's with me, because the Bureau now doesn't deem me as a member anymore. I mean, I have been expelled from the party by its decision 2-3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So do I feel less of an ARF member? No, I don't. And I'm one of the believers. I know that within the party, there are those who believe that if you're not a member of the ARF, then you can't talk about the ARF, so to speak.
Right.
Or you can only praise it. You can't talk anything about it. I'm not one of those that believe that. I think the ARF belongs to the Armenian people. The ARF dies without the Armenian people. Armenian people are expected to assist in the ARF's projects and the ARF's mission, and therefore they're going to have something to say about the ARF and its policies and its leadership even, and so on. So I think all of this, ultimately, after the pain, which is great, if you're an ARF member or ARF sympathizer or even just an observer, you can't feel anything but pain seeing the ARF going through some turmoils. But then again, you know, if you look at it from a different perspective, you say, okay, crises happen. Now, is there an opportunity that's going to come out of that? Or are you just going to succumb to the crisis and be done with? I'm a believer that opportunities can evolve out of this, and I'm hopeful. You just need open minds and you need the foresight that leaders in previous generations in the ARF have had it, by the way.
Yeah.
There have been some very serious rifts in the organization. But they have managed it, they have brought people together, and they've moved on. And the ARF has come out of that stronger.
How do you see the party reconciling from this and moving forward as a united organization then? You actually sound hopeful towards that.
Well, I'm hopeful in the sense that, if I'm just to look at the discourse, which is, you know, Facebook and so on and so forth, of course, there's nothing to be hopeful about, right? All the mudslinging and so on. But I believe in the good nature of ARF members, and I think most, if not all, ARF members are good people, good Armenians, devoted Armenians. And so I think reason will prevail, and people will come together and search for solutions to this. You know, I don't know if this is going to happen in a month or two, or if it's going to happen in a year or two. But whether there are elections in Armenia or no elections, whether there's Pashinyan or no Pashinyan, there were some disagreements back in Serge Sarkisian's time. There were other disagreements back in Levon Derpetrosyan's time. There's always these disagreements on different levels. The question becomes, where does the ARF see itself, okay, in all of this, in the Armenian reality? Am I personally happy that we are presenting ourselves in Armenia the way we are? No, I'm not. Okay, I would rather see the ARF lead a process independently by its own worldview, its own ideals, its own past, its own everything, its own resources, okay, on its own, and say this is what we stand for as ARF. Go to the elections as the ARF. I don't even know if we're going to or not. Final decision, as far as I know, hasn't been made yet. Just be out there. Sure, we have a lot of things working against us, but then again, it's okay. You overcome, you provide service to the people, and our walk has to go along with our talk. We have to deliver on what we promise. And you do that, and in time, I think any population, any civil society will reward fulfilled promises. Yep. I'm a believer in that. Yep. I mean, it may sound a little bit too naive or too quote-unquote Western, but I don't think so. I think the Armenian people have enough common sense. And the example I give is back in 2013, if you recall, Rafi Ovenesyan ran for president.
Right.
Okay. Ultimately, Rafi said he won the elections. Serge Sarkisian came out with certain percentages and said Rafi got, what was it, like 39%, whatever. Even if Serge Sarkisian's numbers were correct, the ones that he was offering, saying Rafi got 39%. Listen, wasn't it amazing that a diasporan Armenian who had moved to Armenia when? In 1990-91?
Right, yeah.
Was garnering 39% of the votes in a country where he had no real biography. I'm sure he had been foreign minister for a short period of time, but beyond that, he had just gone and worked in civic society and fought for certain ideals and so on. And yet 39% of the people came back and said, we want Rafi Ovenesyan to be president. Now, this is an amazing phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
Which goes to show you that the people in Armenia, they're in a constant search. They look at people, they gauge, and they say, okay, well, this person or that person is full of promises and full of hope. I would like to go out there. Same thing happened with Pashinyan. I mean, Pashinyan, a couple of months before April, right, 2018, Pashinyan, if he had a rally, he would, what, gather, what, 500 people, 600 people, if that? So what happened? I know there are like conspiracy theories that the Russians did it, you know. And okay, so how did they do it that in 1 month, 100,000 people were in the streets? Come on. All right. Something else happened, right? Something else clicked with people. It wasn't just a Moscow decision that brought 100,000 people to the streets, right? So what I'm saying is, you just have to inspire hope, and when you promise, you better deliver. When you talk about something, you better walk the walk,
right,
or walk the talk in this case.
Yeah,
you know. So
yeah, talking about soul searching from a diaspora to nation to state to government to an organization, and within this whole context, it's interesting. It always reminds me of Antonio Gramsci's famous words: pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. Thank you so very much, Vikan.
Sure.
This has been quite
Absolutely.
Insightful. Nice conversation, interesting conversation. And we look forward to having you again down the line.
Thank you, Vikan.
Thank you very much, guys. And my challenge to you is for you to challenge our political elite and thinkers that you have your conversations with, chats with, to start thinking about our strategies for the future. And as lately I've been talking about and writing about this, we're not the first nation or the first state that has had major losses or collapses, so to speak. We've had many, many instances where the collapse has been even more total than what happened with Armenia or Armenians. And the most immediate examples come to mind is Germany after World War II, or even Japan. Just imagine the national pride in Japan, how it was totally collapsed.
Destroyed. Yeah.
They had gone and destroyed, and they had gone into deep depression with all their pride and whatever, and they came out of it. If somebody is to tell me, well, you know, Germany or Japan were wealthier nations, that's hogwash, because their industries were totally destroyed. Sure, they had Western sponsorship, the Marshall Plan and whatever, the U.S. that came and helped them. But you know what? There was the resilience that was present there was based on a realization that after all, we're on our own. And there is nothing wrong with thinking that Armenians are on their own. We say this or almost in a lamenting fashion, in almost like a self-victimizing fashion, that we're left alone in this world and blah, blah, blah. But really, there's a lot of power in that realization. Mm-hmm. You need to understand that if you don't help yourself, nobody's going to come to your help. And no superpower or no international power is going to want to help or assist or ally itself with or relate to a country which folds at the first sign of failure, all right? And so we had a huge failure. The blame game, one side, okay, so let's do that and let's find those who are responsible and so on and so forth. But we need to move on and build this country and build the economy with certain strategies. Okay, when I talk about national strategies, that's how far I'm going, all right? So,
yeah.
You can't just say, come and invest in Armenia. You need to say, guys, we are looking to develop the pharmaceutical industry because that serves our national agenda. I mean, I don't want to go into detail. As I said, I don't want to go too much into it because that's a discussion topic.
A different discussion,
totally,
but I
yes.
understand what you mean. A complete strategy with a plan, with a roadmap, et cetera.
Right. You can't just go and be welcomed if you just, I mean, sure, you want investments in Armenia, but if I'm investing in building a shopping mall versus I want to build, you know, like I said, the pharmaceutical manufacturing facility, those can't be treated the same way by the government, right? I mean, logic says that they have to develop. They came out and start saying that high tech is a priority. Okay, they need to explain why,
and what
how,
did they do
and so on.
To promote that priority?
Exactly. I mean, so they had a ministry, and you know, they may have done good things. I don't know. I haven't followed it too closely. But what I'm trying to say is, to come back to all of it, and to conclude, we need a national ideology, a set of ideals and set of priorities. That's what we need.
Thank you, Vikan.
Thank you, Vikan.
Thank you, guys.
That concludes this Conversations on Grung episode. We hope it was helpful in your understanding of some of the issues involved. We look forward to your feedback, including your suggestions for conversation topics in the future. Contact us on our website at grung.org or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. On behalf of everyone in this episode, we wish you a good week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels, like our pages, and follow us on social media. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.